morning. Last lecture. So we're going to continue discussing problems with the standard model. There's going to be a whole list we're going to go through. I'm going to try to make it through all of them. All of them, all right? We'll see. Maybe I'll forget some. You'll have to remind me. Now, the first one, maybe this is like the biggest, but also perhaps the simplest, we'll see, is neutrino masses, because we know experimentally that neutrinos do have mass. So the mass of at least two out of the three neutrinos must be larger than zero, but all of them have to be smaller than around an EV or so. Now, it's straightforward to introduce neutrino masses in the standard model. I just need to introduce the corresponding right-handed field, the right-handed neutrino field, and then I can write down Yukawa interactions the same way we did for all of the other fermions. And so we show that this can work straightforwardly, and then we wrote down the charge current interaction. It's no longer diagonal. And we introduce this PM and S mixing matrix. Okay? But that's not the end of the story, because we had to introduce this right-handed neutrino field. And the quantum numbers of this field are as follows. Of course, it's a singlet under SU3 color. Okay, so this means the trivial representation under color. It's a singlet under SU2 left, obviously, because it's right-handed. And then it also carries zero hypercharge. So it's a singlet under all of the standard model gauge groups. And that means I can write down another mass term. So I can write down the following mass term. So far, we've introduced Yukawa masses through Yukawa interactions. Those have all been Dirac masses. So of the form, you know, psi bar psi. We can we only have a single vial spinner. We can introduce a mass term through a Majorana mass, and in particular, because the right-handed neutrino field is a singlet, this is the only field I can write down a Majorana mass term for. So it would take the following form. 1/2 MIJ, and so I have a new bar right I, and then a new right charge conjugate J, plus the Hermitian conjugate, which would be new right I charge conjugate, and then new right J. So C denotes charge conjugation. And let me clarify the notation a little bit. When I write down new right C, this is, I take the new right field, so the right-handed neutrino field, and then I charge conjugate it. So this is, I take my neutrino field, I act on it with the right-handed projector, and then I do the charge conjugation. This is not the same thing as doing these operations the other way around. So taking the neutrino field, charge conjugating it, and then acting on it with the right-handed projector. Okay? So, all right? Hopefully that's clear. There's another way, there's another form of notation, which is described in, you know, Peskin and Schroeder. They show you how to write down Majorana masses, but I think their notation is more confusing, so I like this notation a little bit better. It makes it more clean. Okay, so in general, we have another mass matrix appearing in the problem. So we have our Dirac mass matrix coming from the Yukawa matrix, and we have another mass matrix coming from this Majorana term. So the mass eigenstates, there's going to be some combination of diagonalizing these mass matrices. So it's a little bit complicated to do. What we're going to do to illustrate what's going on is we're just going to do one flavor for simplicity. So suppose we just have one flavor, and we'll show what are the implications of having both a Majorana mass and a Dirac mass. So all of the neutrino masses can be written in the following way. So I have my Dirac mass, which I'll write as little m, and then I'll have nu right bar nu left plus nu left bar nu right. And then I have my Majorana mass for the right-handed fields. Like this. Maybe it's obvious, but I can't write down a Majorana mass for the left-handed fields. That would violate the gauge invariance. Particular hypercharge, for example, violate hypercharge. Okay. Now, let me note the following facts, and this is why I like this notation here, because it'll allow us to write this mass term in a pretty simple and illustrative way. So let's note the following. And I'm not going to prove these relations, but it's not too hard to do. So if I write down nu right bar nu left, this is the same thing as nu left charge conjugate, nu right charge conjugate. So if I charge conjugate these things, that will just flip the order around. And also the same thing for the opposite combinations of helicity, or chirality, I should say. Okay, so this allows me to write the mass terms in a sort of a compact way in matrix form. So I have minus 1/2, and then I have the charge conjugate fields, like this, and then a mass matrix, 0, M, M, capital M, and then these fields, like so. Plus emission conjugate. So finding the mass eigenvalues amounts to just diagonalizing this matrix. And when we diagonalize, the eigenstates that we get will be two Majorana fermions. So we have two Majorana fermions. And I'll denote them by nu and capital N. And then the mass term will be as follows. I'll have a 1/2 M nu times nu bar C nu minus 1/2 M N. Let me write it like this. The mass of this N field times N bar C N, like so, and plus emission conjugate, I think. Is it? I think I need to include plus emission conjugate. Okay, so this is the mass term for two Majorana fermions. And just by finding the eigenvalues of this mass matrix, I can find these mass eigenvalues. And they take the following form. Well, I can, it's straightforward to figure out what the eigenvalues of this matrix are. I'm going to consider them in a particular limit, which will be interesting. So let me motivate this limit in the following way. So I started out with my two mass terms as follows. Now, when I look at the Yukawa mass terms, the mass terms induced by the Yukawa interactions, they can't be too large. And the reason is that they'll always scale proportional to some coupling constant times the VeV, the Higgs VeV. The Higgs VeV is a fixed number. I can't make that any larger than 246 GeV. The Yukawa coupling is also bounded because I don't want it to become non-perturbatively large. I want to maintain this theory as a weakly coupled theory. And so that limits the size of this Dirac mass term that might appear. On the other hand, the Majorana term has no such restriction. There's no reason to take this mass parameter M to be the electroweak scale. In principle, it could be much larger than the electroweak scale, or it could be much smaller, but there's a good motivation for considering the case where it's much larger. In that limit, that M is much, much larger than Y times V, which is my Dirac mass, then the mass eigenvalues take the following form. So the mass of this neutrino N is approximately just M. And so I have one very heavy neutrino here. And then the mass of the other neutrino is approximately M squared over capital M. So this number here, little m, is something that's of order the electroweak scale or lighter, whereas this number here is something that is much larger. So the argument with this scenario is saying that the reason that neutrinos are light is because this scale, capital M, is very heavy. And this idea is known as the seesaw mechanism. So for example, let's take y to be around, 10 to the minus 2, or yeah, 10 to the minus 2, let's say. So this is like the same Yukawa as, the tau lepton, for example. So something like that, a normal size Yukawa coupling. V is what it is, and so then y times v is around 1 GeV. And now let's take this mass capital M to be some large scale, and I'm just picking numbers here. Let's just say it's 10 to the 9 GeV. So just something that's much larger than the electroweak scale. This implies that the mass of the neutrino is YV squared divided by this capital M, and that turns out to be 1 EV. So this is showing how you can get a very light scale, electron volt or less, through the combination of one mass, which is around the electroweak scale, and one very heavy scale. That's how neutrinos become light. On the other hand, if you only had Dirac masses to work with, or Dirac neutrinos, so these are known as Majorana neutrinos. For Dirac neutrinos, you only have this Dirac mass, and so the mass of the neutrino would just be y times v. In order to get something smaller than an electron volt, you need this Yukawa coupling y to be less than around 10 to the minus 12. So why is that Yukawa coupling so small? 10 to the minus 12 seems weird, but could be true. So we don't know which picture is the right one. OK. Now, let me just go through quickly some of the experiment. Yes?
Sorry. So what are these other n fermions?
So those are heavy neutrinos. Now they're both Majorana fermions. The light ones are very similar to the neutrinos that we wrote down in the standard model. So these are the standard model-like neutrinos. But then these heavy ones are mostly singlet neutrinos. And so they're just heavy fermions that interact very weakly with standard model. Yes.
So in order to from this theory, we would go at like 10 to the 9 GeV and see if we find a fermion at this scale.
Yes, yes.
And is it realistic or it's more?
No, we can't build a collider at 10 to the 9 GeV. It's too heavy.
I mean, this theory is realistic. Like we haven't read really that.
Okay. Yeah, it's totally realistic. It's very appealing for these different reasons. So, for example, okay, naturally explains why neutrinos are so light. The other appealing feature is that it can also explain why there's more matter than antimatter in the universe. So it can also shed light on that puzzle too. All right. Now, let me talk about some of the experimental consequences for neutrino mass. This is going to be very brief, since we have a lot of problems to get through. So consequence one is known as neutrino oscillations. And this comes from the fact, so let me just motivate what's going on here. So let's suppose that you have a proton beam that collides on some target. The target will produce lots of hadrons. Some of those hadrons will be pions. So let's say I have a pi plus. Turns out that most pi pluses, maybe you don't know what a pi plus pi plus is. It's a combination of a U quark and a D bar. Okay, if you didn't know. Most pi pluses decay in the following way. They decay into an anti-muon and a muon neutrino. So this is a good way to get a beam of neutrinos of a specific flavor, in particular the muon flavor. So now what happens to those neutrinos? Well, the neutrino doesn't interact much with anything, and so it can propagate over long distances and then eventually be detected in some very large detector. And the question is, when it's detected, what is the flavor of this neutrino? When it gets absorbed through the weak interaction, does it produce a muon or does it produce some other type of charged lepton? Now, when you have massless neutrinos, a muon neutrino will just stay as a muon neutrino. But now, if we include neutrino masses, then neutrino flavors can oscillate from one type to the other. And the reason is as follows. So let's suppose I start out with a muon neutrino. It's some linear combination of the mass eigenstates. That linear combination is just set by this P, M, and S matrix. And so the linear combination is just U, 2, 1, times the mass eigenstate 1 plus U 2, 2 times mass eigenstate 2 plus U 2, 3 times mass eigenstate 3. So you create this quantum superposition of the different eigenstates. Those different eigenstates will have different masses, and so as they propagate in time, they will each evolve with a different factor of e to the I ht, or e to the I et. Mass eigenstates evolve. So if I look at the time evolution of one of these eigenstates, it goes like e to the minus I ei times t over h bar times whatever the mass eigenstate is. So they each evolve with their own quantum mechanical phase factor. And so then after some time, when they're finally observed again, you'll have a different superposition, which means that you'll have a different flavor coming out. So that's the idea of neutrino oscillations. You could have a different quantum superposition. And that's due to the fact that these energies are different, meaning that the masses of the neutrinos are different. Okay. So this type of probe is sensitive to neutrino mass, but it's sensitive to both Dirac and Majorana type masses. In fact, it doesn't distinguish between the two cases. The second type of probe is known as neutrinoless double beta decay. And this is sensitive to Majorana masses, but not Dirac masses. And so if we observed this process, which it hasn't been observed yet, it's been searched for, but hasn't been observed yet, that would confirm that neutrinos are Majorana, meaning that there's some mechanism, either this or something like this, that generates these Majorana mass terms for neutrinos. So let me explain what neutrinoless double beta decay is. Now, the first thing that you have to know, if I have Majorana neutrinos, or any Majorana fermion, then the particle is the same as an antiparticle. So in this case, neutrinos would be their own antiparticles. In this case, neutrinos and an antineutrino are different fields, different fermions.
But in the first case, I don't understand, because this is a mix of a Dirac and a Majorana, but at the end, it's just a Majorana?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a mix of Dirac and Majorana is Majorana.
Okay.
Now, so let's see how this works. So for this process, neutrinoless double beta decay. Double beta decay is like beta decay, but it's two beta decays happening at the same time. So let's say I have some nucleus. And in that nucleus, I have two neutrons. And both of those neutrons are going to undergo beta decay. So I have a U D D and a D D U. And so both of these will undergo beta decay. And each beta decay will convert one of these D quarks into a U quark. By exchanging a W boson and producing an electron and an antineutrino. So this is two beta decays happening simultaneously. Why can't you just have one beta decay? Well, for certain nuclei, having just one beta decay is not allowed because it would lead you to a more energetic nucleus that would have a higher mass. So that it could be kinematically forbidden, but having two beta decays occur simultaneously may be allowed. And so it can undergo these two beta decays. Okay, and so we have this process. Now, if neutrinos are their own antiparticles, then you can also write down another diagram that contributes to this process. So instead of having neutrinos in the final states, I can have a virtual neutrino. So I have two antineutrinos that connect to the electron lines. But because neutrinos are their own antiparticle, I can draw a diagram like this, which has clashing arrows. I don't need to conserve fermion number for Majorana fermions. So I have this internal neutrino. And so this is what it means for neutrino-less double beta decay. There's no neutrinos coming off in the final state. So the process is that I have a nucleus with n neutrons plus z protons. And it goes to n minus 2 neutrons, z plus 2 protons, and 2 electrons, and no neutrinos. It's relying on the fact that for Majorana neutrinos, lepton number is not conserved. So this violates lepton number. Okay. Now, all right. So I wanted to say a few things more about the seesaw mechanism, but let me skip that because I have a lot of other things I want to talk about. But let me just sort of whet your appetite and say that the seesaw mechanism looks very beautiful. But this particular realization where I introduce right-handed neutrino fields is not the only way to implement the seesaw mechanisms. There's a bunch of other ways as well.
Why is it called a seesaw?
Because you're starting with something very heavy, and then you produce something very light. And then you just make wave your arms like this. Okay. So observing this process, let me just make this point, shows you that neutrinos are Majorana, but it doesn't confirm the existence of the heavy right-handed neutrinos, because there's other ways to get Majorana masses too. Okay. But I'll skip over that part. Now, I want to talk about some other problems with the standard model. The second problem is, what is the origin of flavor? So there's a lot of parts to this question. For example, you know, why three generations? Why is there a hierarchy in the Yukawa couplings? So for example, yt is around 1, but y for the electron is around 3 times 10 to the minus 6. So why are these numbers so different? Or if you like, why are the masses of the fermions so different in the standard model? The other question is, why are the CKM matrix and PMNS matrices so different? The CKM matrix is a matrix of numbers. In principle, there's a complex phase appearing in some of these entries, but I'll just show you the magnitudes of the numbers appearing in this matrix. They take the following form: 0.97, 0.23, 0.004, 0.23, 0.97, 0.04. 0.009, 0.04, 0.999. That's the CKM matrix. The thing about the CKM matrix, it seems almost equal to the identity. It's really close. It's dominated by the diagonal parts. And so it's sort of almost the identity. For the PMNS matrix, I'll write down those numbers as well. Actually, this last one up here in the upper right was only measured a few years ago, so all right, so if I gave the lecture 5 years ago, I would have just had a blank here. So there's some progress. Now you can see that these things have very different forms. This one looks closely aligned with the identity matrix. This one just looks like a bunch of random numbers. So this might be just anarchy. I don't know what else to call it. People have different ways of generating, people have different ideas for how to make, or sort of how to tease out patterns from these numbers, but it doesn't really look like there is. But who knows? So in any case, these two things are very different from one another. We don't know why. Now, okay. So that's a puzzle. The third is going to be a collection of problems which will go under the general umbrella of unification. So why do we have three gauge groups? Why does SU2 left cross U1Y violate parity? Can quarks and leptons be unified? Why do fermions have these sort of ad hoc hypercharges? So this sort of has to do with kind of the, what is, you know, why does the structure of the standard model have the form that it does? So attempts to solve these issues have been made through what are called grand unified theories. So these are known as guts. Now, one grand unified theory, which is very minimal, perhaps the most minimal gut, is known as the Patti-Salam model. So this Patti-Salam model is based on the following gauge group, SU4 cross SU2 left cross SU2 right. And so one of the ingredients for this model is that it restores parity in the sense that it puts the right-handed fields on the same footing as the left-handed fields. So I have an SU2 left, it's the same as in the standard model, but now I have an SU2 right, which is an SU2 acting on the right-handed fields. Now, the other feature of this model is that it unifies together quarks and leptons. So, for example, I have now a left-handed fermion, psi left, and its quantum numbers under these three gauge groups will be as follows. So it'll be a fundamental under the SU4, a fundamental under the SU2 left, and then a singlet under the SU2 right. And so this field will be as follows. So it's a fundamental under SU4, and so I'll write the four components going down, and it's a fundamental under SU2, so I'll write the SU2 components going across. So it's going to be a 4 by 2, and the components will be for the first three, these are going to be the quark fields of three different colors. So red, green, and blue. And then I'll have, so it's SU2, and so I need to put in the SU2 part of the doublet. So I have D left red, D left green, and D left blue. And now the really beautiful part of the theory is for the fourth component of this SU4, you put in the lepton fields. And so I would put in the lepton doublet. So I would have a nu left and an e left. So you can see that the first three components transform under color. And so color is going to be embedded. The SU3 for color will be embedded in this SU4. But then lepton number forms the fourth color in this SU4. There's another field, which is the psi right. Has the following quantum numbers. It's just a singlet under the SU2 and a doublet under the SU2 right. It's the same as what I wrote here, just with you just swap left for right. So it has a very symmetric structure. There's a series of left-handed fields and a series of right-handed fields. So the other really beautiful feature of this model is that the hypercharges emerge naturally. So U1y emerges as a combination of generators for the SU4 and the SU2 right. So it's similar to what happened in the standard model. Remember, the electric charges emerged as a combination of SU2 left and U1 hypercharge. Here, the hypercharges emerge through a combination of SU4 and SU2 right. And they give exactly the values that we had for the standard model. OK, so that's one model. You can see it's not really a complete unification. The standard model has three gauge groups. This has three gauge groups. So we haven't really unified any of the gauge sector, but we've unified the matter sector of the standard model. OK. The other type of unification model is SU5, written down by Georgi and Glashow. And you already did, I think, some problems with SU5. Is that right? You did it already.
It's due on Sunday.
Oh, it's not due yet. OK. Oh, it's due.
Tell us about it.
I can tell you about it. OK. OK. So SU5 is perhaps the most famous grand unified theory. And the reason that it's so appealing is that it unifies all three standard model gauge groups together. So SU3 color cross SU2 left cross U1y are all embedded in a single gauge group, SU5. Standard model fermions all fits into two representations. So one is I have an anti-fundamental representation, a 5-bar, and this is so you start out with the right-handed down-type quarks, complex conjugated. And then you also put in the left-handed lepton fields here. So here you have three colors. And here you have two SU2 components. So SU2 left is acting on the lower two components, and then SU3 color is acting on the upper three components. OK? This is not all of the fermions. You need to include another representation, which is the an anti-symmetric representation. So it's a 10-dimensional representation. And it takes the following form. It's a matrix. A matrix that's anti-symmetric has to be 0 on the diagonal. And then in the different components, I have to put in U right C, B. I have minus, so I need to make this matrix bigger. Minus U right C green. And then I have U right C red. Then I have U left red, B left red. U left green, D left green, U left blue, D left blue, and then finally I have E right conjugated like this. and then 0, 0, 0, 0. And then here is the same things, just with a minus sign. So these are how all of the different standard model fields are embedded in these two representations. But it's a little bit kludgy. You know, why do we have these particular representations? Anyways. Now, kind of maybe the ultimate grand unified theory is known as SO10. And this was written down by George I. SU10 contains, first of all, it can unify together all of the gauge groups of the standard model. So all of these gauge groups can be embedded in the standard model. And the other nice feature is that it unifies together all of the matter content in the standard model. You can write down all of the fields, all of the fermion fields inside of a single representation. So all standard model fermions plus the right-handed neutrino in one 16-dimensional representation of SO10. So it puts together everything in just one multiplet of this gauge group. And this is only for one particular generation. So this is only for each generation. So you still would need three different copies for the three generations. SO10 is also a generalization of the other groups that I wrote down. So SO10 also contains SU5 as a subgroup. So SU5 can be embedded in SO10. Also, the Patti-Salam model can also be embedded in SO10. So both of these cases, if you like, are sort of subcases of this larger group. And then at the end of the day, both of these can be broken down to give you the standard model gauge group. OK. So it looks like we're on the right track with unification. Things are getting simpler and simpler the more we unify things together. So let me try to sketch out my perspective on this issue. So let's try to make a sort of a plot of how complicated sort of the matter sector is and the gauge sector is for these different theories. So we have kind of the gauge fermion sector for these different theories. And the axes are just going to go from simple too complicated. And the standard model, you would say, is the most complicated case. So I'll put it over here. Now, the next most complicated case would be the Patti-Salam model. Then SU5. And then SO10 is the simplest case that you can have. But of course, the standard model and whatever a theory is contains not just gauge fields and not just fermion fields, but it also has to include Higgs fields. And the standard model is quite remarkable because you only need one Higgs doublet to do everything that the Higgs needs to do in terms of generating masses for all of the different particles, whether they're gauge bosons or fermions. So I can put another axis to this plot, which will represent the Higgs sector. Also going from simple to complicated. The standard model would be the most simplest type of Higgs sector you could write down that's allowed phenomenologically. And then what you find is if you actually try to build realistic versions of these grand unified theories, the simpler that you make the rest of the theory, the more complicated the Higgs sector has to be. For example, if you want to build a realistic theory with SO10, you need 100 dimensional representations of the Higgs fields of this theory. So is that so appealing? I don't know. It kind of, you're sort of trading simplicity in one aspect for another, and that's the end of the story. So you can kind of almost sort of draw a line, and you sort of have to live along this one-dimensional line in this parameter space, and sort of it kind of hints to a sort of a conservation law in model building for unification theories, sort of a conservation of complexity. You can't generate, a simple theory in everything, at least that we know how. Okay. Now, problem number four is known as the hierarchy problem. Now, let me phrase it in the following way. The standard model has one dimensionful parameter. Which is the mass squared term that appears in the Higgs potential. So I'll write this as minus mu squared, and this is around 100 GeV. So the question is, why this value? The other dimensionful parameter that we know is the Planck scale. So this is related to 1 over the square root of Newton's constant. And this turns out to be 10 to the 19 GeV. So it's kind of a weird feature. You know, we have this scale due to gravity at this very high scale. And in particle physics, everything seems to be related to this scale, at least in the electric weak sector. And so why are these two scales much different? So they differ by a factor of 10 to the 17. So it seems very odd. Now, there's many ways to sort of illustrate that this is a problem. And people have criticized these arguments in different ways. Let me write down the argument that I think is sort of convincing. So it's phrased in terms of the Higgs mass. And the Higgs is a scalar, and its mass receives radiative corrections due to any type of field that couples to the Higgs. And in particular, the heavier the new state that couples to the Higgs, the heavier the bigger the correction will be. So let me take someone's favorite theory of new physics. And so as an example, let's take the seesaw mechanism for an example. So let's say we have this seesaw. So we'll do the seesaw theory with these heavy neutrinos n. And I'm just going to take particular parameters just to illustrate what's going on. So let's take our Yukawa coupling to be 10 to the minus 2, our mass to be 10 to the 9, as we did before. And so with these parameters, let's just compute the correction to the Higgs mass. So this correction to the Higgs mass squared comes from the following diagram, where I have a heavy neutrino and a light neutrino. Like this. And it turns out that this correction goes like y squared over 16 pi squared times this heavy mass squared. So if I just plug in the following numbers, this correction turns out to be 10 to the 6 GeV squared. So the correction is actually much larger than the mass of the Higgs itself. And so what I need to say is that the mass of the Higgs appearing as a parameter in the tree-level Lagrangian cannot be 125 GeV squared. It has to be this number plus 125 GeV squared. So then when I sort of subtract off this quantity, I would receive, you know, the number I want, 125 GeV. So let me formulate that in a little more detail. So I would say that the total mass of the Higgs, and I want this to be 125 GeV squared, has to be some bare Higgs mass plus the radiative correction. And this number has to be 125 GeV plus 10 to the 12. Sorry, this would be 125 GeV squared plus 10 to the 12 GeV squared. And then I subtract off, oh no, I need to put the minus sign here, let's say. And then I need to subtract off, or add to it, 10 to the 6 GeV squared like this. So that at the end of the day, I get the number that I want. And so I need to tune this bare parameter so that it very precisely cancels off any new physics correction that I would get at a very high scale. So it's very strange that that would actually occur. Okay. All right, so I'm running out of time, and so I can't make it through all of the problems, but I want to make it through one last problem, which I think is very, very interesting. And it's only sort of really emerged since the Higgs boson was discovered in 2012. So which number am I on? 5? So problem 5 is the problem of the Higgs quartic and the fates of the electroweak vacuum. So, to start with, let's define our Higgs field in the following way. So we have our Higgs field H, and let's put it in unitary gauge. So then I can write it as 0 times 0 for the top component, and then some real field phi divided by the square root of 2. The electroweak vacuum corresponds to the vacuum expectation value of phi being just this VeV, which is around 246 GeV. So we understand why we get this number. So at tree level, the Higgs potential, or I should say at tree level, the electroweak vacuum is stable. And that's just due to the fact that the potential can be written in the following way. mu squared over 2, phi squared, plus lambda over 4, phi to the fourth. And so it's simple to find the minimum. The minimum is just this. Okay. Now, one of the restrictions that we implemented in our potential was that this parameter lambda had to be positive. If lambda is negative, we run into problems because as you go to larger and larger values of the fields, the potential would become more and more negative. You just fall down this runaway direction down the hill. You'd be destabilized. So it looks like this doesn't occur, but we actually need, the argument is actually a little bit more subtle that we need to go through. So the question is, what happens at large field values well, it's really only the quartic term that's going to be important. This term will be relatively suppressed. By large values, I mean that phi is much, much larger than the VeV, the electroweak VeV. So I can write the potential as 1 over 4 lambda phi to the fourth. Now, once I make the field very, very large, then certain masses of fermions and gauge bosons also become very large. So for example, the top mass and the W mass scale proportional to phi. And so all of these masses are going to be much larger than the scale of the electroweak VeV. So I'll have new scales in my theory that will contribute to one-loop processes, which will be important. So I have a large mass scale. So now if I look back at the potential, I have this parameter lambda appearing in the potential. The parameter lambda, you usually evaluate that at the electroweak scale when you compute the electroweak vacuum. But now, because I have these large masses appearing, I have new very high mass scales. I need to worry about how lambda itself will depend on mass scale. So I should write lambda as a function of some renormalization group scale mu. So how does it depend on mu? So let me write lambda like this. So in the standard model, lambda is around 0.1. And let me draw 0 here. And this will be around minus 0.04 at the bottom. The electroweak scale will be 10 to the 2 GeV. And I'm going to see how it depends on the scale up to the Planck scale, which is around 10 to the 19 GeV. And the axis here is the mu direction. So here's what the renormalization group for a lambda looks like. And I'm going to skip through how one would actually compute it. It's not too complicated now that you're all experts in computing beta functions. So what happens is around the electric weak scale, it's around 0.1. But then it falls off with mass scale. And then eventually, it actually will become negative at sufficiently high values of the renormalization group scale. And where it becomes negative is somewhere between 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 11 GeV. Now, let me write the potential again. So I have V as a function of phi. And the quartic term will be lambda as a function of mu times lambda to the fourth. So if I want to compute where the minimum is, I need to figure out what scale I should plug into the potential. And since the scale is being set by the value of the fields, let's just take mu to be the value of the field itself. So now, because lambda will become negative for values of the fields larger than 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 11 GeV, that means that the potential will become negative. And in fact, a field will be able to run away to very large values of the fields once it becomes larger than this value here. So it tells you that the potential is destabilized for phi larger than around 10 to the 11 GeV. And so that tells you that there must be some new minimum. At a very large value of phi. So, the electroweak vacuum, if the standard model is correct, if the standard model is correct up to these high scales, the electroweak vacuum is not the most stable point. There is a new, more stable, a lower energy point at very large values of this field. So this is problematic because the universe wants to be at the spot with the lowest energy. So here's the caveats. If the standard model is correct, up to the Planck scale, then the electroweak vacuum is not the minimum of the Higgs potential. And so let me illustrate this in a different way by drawing the phase diagram for the standard model. And what I'm drawing here comes from the following reference. The reference is, I'll just give you the archive number, 1205-6497. So the phase diagram means, is the electric vacuum stable or is it unstable as a function of some parameters? The parameters are the Higgs mass. The other parameter which we're going to include is the top mass. The reason we want to include the top mass is because the top quark gives the largest contribution to the beta function for lambda. And so the Yukawa coupling for the top is going to strongly affect how this running behaves, meaning the top quark mass will be an important parameter. OK, so let me draw some axes here. So this will be 0 up to around 200 or so GeV. And this will be 0 up to 200 GeV. We live, so here will be 100. Here will be 100. And we live 125 and 173, which is around, let's say, here. So this is us. Maybe 100 should be here. Now, the region of this phase space where the standard model would be stable, the electric vacuum would be stable, corresponds to the following area of parameter space. It looks something like this. So we are not in it, but we are close. There's also another region of parameter space which we don't want to get into, which is over here, Here, the couplings become non-perturbative at some energy scale. So we want to stay out of this region due to non-perturbativity of the couplings. Okay, all right, so we don't need to worry about that. Now, you might worry, because if we're not in the lowest stable minimum of the potential, we could quantum mechanically tunnel from where we are, the electric vacuum, to the lowest energy part. And so the whole universe could transition from the electric vacuum to this lowest energy point at very high values of the field. So the whole universe could decay at any moment. At any moment, it could decay. So I need to finish up quickly. But we can actually do this computation of computing the tunneling time for this decay and comparing it to the age of the universe. We could be living in this region where the universe is what's called metastable, which means that it's unstable, but the decay time is so long that we don't need to worry about it. So the metastability region is actually turns out to be something like this. And then above, we are unstable. So we would have decayed by now. So it's weird. It is very weird why we seem to live in this very tiny sliver of the phase space, which corresponds to the universe being metastable. And this is another problem that we don't understand. OK. There's a bunch of other problems. We don't have time. We're done. OK. If there are any questions on any of these things, I can answer questions. Yes. Number six is known as the strong CP problem. This corresponds to the fact that the strong interaction seems to conserve CP. It's not really a surprise because I wrote down the theory of the strong interaction and it conserves CP, but I didn't write down all of the terms in the strong interaction that you can write down. And I omitted one particular term in a Lagrangian, which takes the following form. Epsilon mu nu alpha beta g mu nu, or let me do a trace. This is the gluon field, g alpha beta. So you would contract together the field strength tensors with this antisymmetric tensor. And this object here is proportional to some number times a parameter, which is known as theta QCD. So it turns out that this interaction violates CP symmetry in the strong interaction. There's no reason why you shouldn't write it down. But what you get is a contribution. If this interaction exists, it would contribute to a whole variety of different CP violating observables. For example, it would contribute to the electric dipole moment of the neutron, which has been measured very, very precisely. And limits from measurements of that electric dipole moment constrain this parameter theta QCD to be less than around 10 to the minus 10. So if it exists, it must be very, very small, which suggests that perhaps it is exactly zero. Maybe there's some symmetry reason why it should be zero. So that's a puzzle. Some other problems. So number seven, there's a whole bunch of problems having to do with cosmology. So I'll just lump them all together. So why is there a matter-antimatter asymmetry? The standard model is largely CP conserving. The only place that you can violate CP is in the phases of these mixing matrices, the CKM matrix and the PM and S matrix. So the question is, is there sufficient CP violation in the theory to distinguish matter and antimatter cosmologically in order to generate this observational fact that all of the stuff in the universe seems to be made out of matter, but there's very little antimatter? Problem two is, what is dark matter? OK, so this we don't really know. It seems to exist. It's a lot more prominent in the universe than regular matter. We don't know what it is. Number three is a cosmological constant, or dark energy. So this comes from the observational fact that the universe's acceleration seems to be accelerating. The universe's expansion seems to be accelerating as a function of time. So there's some weird energy component to the universe, which goes under the name of dark energy. This is actually really easy to include in the standard model. I just need to include a constant to the Lagrangian. That can solve the problem. But we don't know why that constant has the value it does in order to give us the observed amount of acceleration. Problem four. There's a whole bunch of problems related to something called inflation. And so let me just lump all of those together. There's something called the horizon and flatness problems. And plus the seed of the primordial density fluctuations. So the universe is lumpy. What sourced those lumps that eventually collapsed into structures? Oh, there's one. I'm almost out of time, but there's one more problem. Maybe there's more. I don't remember. There's a. Okay. How do you quantize gravity? That'll be on the homework for this week. Am I forgetting any of the problems? I think this could be it. Okay, that was a long answer to your question.